Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 30th day of Anno Domini 2021. And you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Here comes the news. And while I'm reading the news, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free, 1-800-790-0415. Or text us at 585-205-8887. And of course, if you didn't write all those numbers down, they're on our website, soundbites.org. Bites with a Y. Francis would like us to remind you. This week, Apple published clarifications. It's Apple news all week today. This week, Apple published clarifications to its support documents to address consumer concern that because of the presence of the MagSafe magnet system in new iPhones, the iPhone 12 and its 2020 peers are particularly unsafe to hold in close proximity to a pacemaker or implantable cardioverter defibrillator, or ICD. To give it the new name, because pacemaker is so 20th century. The updated warning from Apple to customers repeats previous statements that keeping any iPhone within 6 inches of an ICD or pacemaker, or within 15 inches while charging wirelessly, is unsafe. The warning also claims the iPhone 12 is not specifically more dangerous than other models. Several weeks back, Heart Rhythm Journal published results of a test wherein it repeatedly found that moving an iPhone 12 with MagSafe close to a patient's ICD interfered with the functioning of that life-saving device. After the report, tech enthusiasts visited forums, Twitter, and Reddit to spread speculation the iPhone 12 was particularly dangerous to people with pacemakers because of the introduction of MagSafe. However, the journal didn't mention that modern smartphones already contain magnets and emit signals that necessitate that users with ICD or pacemakers keep them several inches away from those medical devices, even before the introduction of MagSafe in the iPhone 12 line in 2020. In other words, it is indeed unsafe to hold the iPhone 12 close to these medical devices, but it was also unsafe to do so with the iPhone 11, the iPhone 10, or any number of competing smartphones. In its support document update, Apple claims that the iPhone 12's MagSafe feature does not change its warning because the warning was already in place. Though all iPhone 12 models contain more magnets than prior iPhone models, they're not expected to pose a greater risk of magnetic interference to medical devices than prior iPhone models. Medical devices such as implanted pacemakers and defibrillators might contain sensors that respond to magnets and radios when in close contact. To avoid any potential interaction with these devices, keep your iPhone and MagSafe accessories a safe distance away from your device, more than 6 inches or 15 centimeters apart, or more than 12 inches, 30 centimeters apart if wirelessly charging. But consult with your physician and your device manufacturer's specific guidelines. For those unfamiliar, MagSafe is a feature in new iPhones that, among other things, allows the devices to attach magnetically to a small key or Qi wireless charging pad. This magnetic attachment allows for more optimal charging speed than previous iPhone models. And the reality is that because those magnets are, they got to be fairly strong to, you know, move the mass of an entire iPhone, relatively strong, that they could pose a greater risk. Anyway, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is iPhones are unsafe near pacemakers. And your choices are stepping back, I'll keep that in mind, meh, living on the edge, baby, and other. So far, we have 18 votes, and meh is number one with I'll keep that in mind, just behind that, and again, just behind that, living on the edge, baby. And of course, if you voted other, we would love to have you tell us why and what you meant in the forum. If you go to our website at soundbites.org, scroll down on the right under Fascinating Stuff, you will see the forums And the second forum down is the poll discussion. Currently, at least, the number one item under poll discussions is 30 Jan 21, iPhones are unsafe near pacemakers. So far, there are only three posts in there, and you can certainly join them. And you can join us. Give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415 or text us at 585-205-8887.
People love the convenience of wireless charging, but then you don't get it on your charging pad exactly right. So you wake up in the morning and your battery's dead because it wasn't on the pad exactly right. So Apple introduced the MagSafe, so it locks it into the pad exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have another issue.
Now we have another issue.
Yeah.
And it's important. We have people who are, you know, pacemakery,
yep,
and ICDE, and they really need to remember that. You know, particularly when, of course, I don't know how you get within 15 inches of a charging iPhone unless you're just bending over it,
yeah,
putting your chest right up against it. Maybe you could avoid doing that. But generally speaking, you know, if you keep your phone in your inside pocket, your inside left breast pocket of your coat or jacket or whatever, and you have a pacemaker, but that's always been true. That's always been a problem for people with pacemakers.
And don't keep your phone or anything magnetic near your credit cards.
Exactly right.
Which is odd because they make credit card cases for phones where you're supposed to. I'm hoping there's like a EMI shield in there that can, you know, limit the magnetic field.
Right, because certainly on any phone before the iPhone 12, keeping them there, at least there, it wasn't as bad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But now those things, particularly if you got those pop sockets on the back, you put it right over the charging thing. And if you're not using the charging thing, that seems like a good thing to do.
And the way wallets have been designed for years is all the slots for your credit cards. And they're too close and touching. And so we're seeing a lot more credit cards are now coming with a little sleeve that helps protect the magnet.
Well, some of the wallets now, too, will have in the linings that it's so it can't be detected.
Right, but it's usually just in the back lining.
Mm-hmm.
What Steve is talking about is when you've got all those slots, you start pulling them in and out, they can.
When you fan fold it, you know,
pick
at least
a card, any card.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're covered.
Yes, and that's what they're for, but they don't protect them inside.
In the olden days, when people would keep their floppy disks on their filing cabinet with a magnet so they knew where to keep it.
Yep.
And they knew where to find it later
and wonder why
it stopped working.
We had a guy many, many years ago who bought D-Base back when D-Base was hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And we sold him the thing, and he went home, and the discs were blank. So he brought it back, and indeed the discs were blank. So we gave him another set, and he brought them back, and those were blank. So I tested the third set, and they were fine. Mm-hmm. And he brought them home, and he came back, and they were blank again. And I said, you've got to be putting them near a magnet. That's the only thing that could cause this. He said, no, I don't have any magnets. Well, we ordered another set, and he came and he got them. And as I was talking to him, I walked him out to his car. He started his car, and his phone rang. He was the first person I'd ever seen with a car phone. And it had the old-style bell in it.
Back when it was a giant thing.
Back when it was a giant thing.
Yeah, like
and it had the old-style bell in it. What was the old-style bell?
Magnet.
It was two little bells with a clapper between them, and you had two magnets that went on and off super fast to pull it back and forth.
Yeah.
That erased it. And, of course, he would put the disc right on top of it because that was a good place for it. So we figured out why he was having an issue.
Wild.
It wasn't his fault, but
But who would have thought?
But I said, this is the last time we're going to replace these.
Yeah.
If they're blank again, we know why, and it's your fault.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the reason. And we had many people who over the years, particularly at desks, when the old-style phones were there and they rang with a bell, would put their discs next to the phone. Yeah. You know, you arrange your desk and they're phone and everything's got to be within reach.
Arm's reach. Yep.
And they would often erase discs.
Or on top of the monitor,
Yes.
Let alone the heat would damage the disc. The giant magnets controlling the electron beam would damage your disc, too.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep. All right, let's get to the phones. Our first caller is Doug from Holly, New York. Hiya, Doug. What's up?
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Hope you're all doing well.
Peachy, you?
Not bad. My problem is I have a Synology network, 2-bay. I had two terabyte drives in the enclosure, and I wanted to upgrade those. So I put in 2 4s, and that all went well. What I would like to be able to try and do is use the two terabyte drives that I had in that enclosure. I have an older Black Armor NAS, and when I put the drives in the NAS, I can't connect. I tried to use the Black Armor software that I originally used and doesn't see it. I put them in a USB dock in the system, which sees them. I reformatted them to FAT32, I think. Put them back in the NAS enclosure, and still nothing. I have a direct wired connection to a computer. The computer doesn't see it. The Black Armor software doesn't see it. I'm just wondering if I have to do something else to the drives to get them to be recognized.
Yeah, usually there's a an OS install procedure that you have to do because the NAS just thinks it's two empty drives with nothing with unreadable things. So you have to run whatever the disk setup procedure is. And I've seen some NASs where you can't replace the drives because it comes with the OS pre-installed from the factory.
Okay.
If there's we're looking on Seagate's website. If there's a setup new hard drive program where it can format the drives, load the Linux operating system it's probably using for the NAS functions, that's what you would have to do.
Yeah, I didn't see anything on the Seagate system for it, other than the software, which is fairly old. I installed it, reinstalled it, and it still wouldn't see it.
Yeah, in any device, the device has to announce to the network that there are available drives. If that announce software was built into the old drive, that may not work. Now, what you could do is put the original, essentially boot to old drive back in the in that device. Excuse me.
Okay.
And leave the other 2 terabyte drive in there as well and see if that's recognized. Then you'll know that that's the problem.
Okay. So I've put in the two older drives into that enclosure and doesn't see them. Is there something I'm missing?
You may need to load something into you're using Windows?
No, it's a Mac.
All right, you may need to load something in your Mac that then goes out and knows to go see those drives.
Yeah, I see a program called Discovery that you load to discover the working NAS, but I'm trying to find out how you would set up a new drive in the NAS.
Is that something that's on Seagate's site?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see anything on it. Is there another way I can run out like a third party that Seagate NAS enclosure to get this? I just want to be able to use it for storage. I'm not going to set it up for like media or anything like that.
Well, if you don't need the NAS functionality, you can just get a raw generic USB drive enclosure.
Yeah. It might be. It's an 10, 11 year old box and. I upgraded it about 2 or 3 years ago, and that's when I got the Synology.
What model Black Armor is it?
220.
220, all right. I found the 110 software. Let me find the 220 software.
Yeah, but yes, you generally need some sort of software either in the device itself to announce to the network that it has drives available, or in the Windows machine to tell it there are drives out there. It's one or the other. You've got to have one of those.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when you set up a system on a network, let's say you decide you want to share one of your folders on Windows to another machine on your network. Mm-hmm. You go in and say, I want to share this, and that sets up the announcer for you. Without that announcer, no other machine knows there's a drive available. And the same thing is true in NAS.
Right, yeah. I've tried just about every way to try to get to recognize them on a OS.
Yeah, you have to install the OS onto the empty drives.
Right. I've connected them to, you know, an Ethernet connection to a couple different computers and nothing seems to see it.
But also, if you put the old drives back in, now, were the old drives being recognized originally, or?
Well, no. The older drive, the 2 terabyte drives, came from the Synology. I just upgraded that capacity.
Right. But was that working on the network with the old drives?
No. I didn't actually. No. When I took them out of the Synology case, I put them in a dual USB hub, and nothing. I didn't see anything. I did see them. I reformatted them. I erased what was on there, and that was.
See, because that's the problem within those drives. It might have been a hidden folder. Was all the software?
Wouldn't it have been for Synology instead of now?
Right. That's why you have to get the Black Armor installer. It's called the Discovery utility.
Okay.
That will discover the NAS and reload the software.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I will give it a try again. You think if I connect to put the drives, or one or both of the drives in the USB hub, and try to install with this Discovery software, do you think that might work?
No, the Discovery software is looking for the drives in the NAS.
Yeah.
But if you just want storage, you can just put the drives in a USB hub and tell the Mac to format it, and then you have storage.
Right, yeah. Okay.
Right.
All righty.
But yes, if you do a search in Google for Seagate Black Armor Discovery 220, mm-hmm. it takes you to their website, and you can download the Black Armor Discovery software.
Right.
Which, when installed, will locate the Seagate NAS devices on the network.
Right. It doesn't. No, I tried that. I had the drives in, and like I said, they're functioning.
I'm sorry, did you say you actually loaded the Discovery software on your Mac?
Yes. So I can start the application up, the Discovery software. Well, when I run it, it does not see the NAS.
That's because there's no OS on the NAS yet.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm kind of like I'm on a dead end kind of thing. I think I'm just probably going to try and look for an enclosure for it.
That might be your best bet at this point.
Yeah. Okay. All righty, guys. I hope you have a good day, and thanks for your help.
Thanks. Good luck. It may well be that his NAS. The Black Armor enclosure is not working.
That could be, yeah.
I mean, if it's what we didn't ask him was if it lights up and
mm-hmm.
you can hear the drive spinning and all of that stuff. But that's certainly another possibility.
I see a link on how to reset your NAS to factory defaults, and that may then download the OS that it needs.
Right.
There's a factory reset tool for Windows. All right, so that's going to be a problem for him. Find a friend with Windows.
Right. Or you can do what Dave is doing and try to put Windows on a Raspberry Pi 4.
Oh, yeah. It's
not the 3.
Oh, the 3. Oh. Dude, I was ready to pick that thing up and throw it as far as I could. It was so slow. I mean, paint dries faster than that.
Well, and it should be about 50% faster on the 4 than it is on the 3. So it'll only be as fast as quick drying paint.
That's fine. But like I say, I'm just hooking up an SSD drive to be a file server. You know, it's just going to share a few files across my intranet.
Right.
And that's all I want it for is just that. And like I say, it's a terabyte hard drive. Got it on a good deal. And like I say, yeah, it's proving to be a challenge.
Well, yeah.
And that's the fun of it. I mean,
it is the April 2018 update of Windows 10. So it's not the latest, but you don't care.
No.
You're not using it. You're just.
Yeah, it's. Yeah. I don't care if it's, you know. As long as it's the only issue that I was having, like I was telling you before we came on air, was that it was having trouble seeing the network.
Right.
And so many other folks said, oh, no, I just put it on there, put it in, it boots, and it finds it. And I go,
it doesn't find the wireless network either?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Well, that's still an issue. Wi-Fi is still an issue on the Raspberry Pi 4. With wireless, there is still an issue with that. But Ethernet is supposed to work fine. I mean, the lights come on for it. There's a green one and a yellow one because right. It's a little bit slower. It won't do the speed, the gigabit speed. But that's okay. You know, like you say, I'm not moving huge files or anything else.
Right, you're just accessing a SQLite database.
Yeah, just a SQL database that's even that's not that big.
Well, and in general, if they wrote it properly, it sends a command, which is, you know, give me these results.
Yeah.
Which is a tiny little file. And then you get back the results, and that's however big they are, but generally not huge.
Well, that's where I'm, like I say, I was going to stop and get a bigger SSD card. Micro SD card, because the one I was using,
well, there's your problem,
was only 8 gig. And after I loaded the operating system, I looked at it.
You had nothing left.
And there's a tiny little sliver left. I think it was like 446K.
Yeah.
Left. And I think, that might be a problem. So I'm going to stop and get a 64 meg or 64 gig.
64 gig is, should yeah, be more than enough.
Should be more than enough. But I was surprised though. Like I was telling you before, I have 128 that came with the Raspberry Pi, and for some reason, the Pi doesn't like with well, at least the Windows.
Right.
For some,
I know it'll take it because my Raspberry Pi 4 is using 128 gig, but I'm running Raspbian.
Yeah.
But they don't call it that anymore. They call it, I think, just Debian.
Right, but I don't know if that's out of the bounds for the Windows, because once I put the 8 gig card in, formatted it, same file
procedure,
it booted up all except for finding the network.
Right.
So I'm thinking, all right, I'll for $14 I can pick up another SSD micro SD card, 64 gig, and play around with that and have some fun with that. But yeah, I mean, I even got a little touch screen with it. That you can sit there, because, like I say, for the most part, it's going to go back down in the basement, just sit there,
yep,
and be a file server. Because my current file server, like I was telling you, is probably, I'm going to say, about 19, 20 years old.
Yep.
And it just sits down there and does its thing. And
yeah, but when you've got a 20-year-old server, tick, tick, tick,
yeah. Oh, yeah, I know that, and that's why I'm preparing ahead of time.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Holy cow, that must mean it's Soundbites. Right here in the truly great and truly grateful to you that we can continue to be member-supported with your generous help. Jazz 90.1. See you in a couple minutes.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites. Here's another news item. Are you the type of person? Oh, it sounds like a commercial, doesn't it? Are you the type of person who puts off installing software updates? Don't do that with the latest update for your iPhone or iPad. Apple released an update for iOS 14 on both devices that fixes security flaws that Apple says may have been actively exploited.
And other sites are saying are being actively
destroyed. Yeah, exactly. Apple's not going to say are. They'll say may. The company says details of the flaws were reported by an anonymous researcher, according to a support page detailing the update. For our customers' protection, Apple doesn't disclose, discuss, or confirm security issues until an investigation has occurred and patches or releases are available, said Apple. They also did say additional details will be available soon. To update your iPhone or iPad to iOS 14.4, users can go to Settings, General, then Software Update. Among some of the other changes introduced in iOS 14.4, the ability for phones to recognize smaller QR codes, seriously, and fixes to the keyboard typing and fitness widgets. Have you updated your iPhone yet? Give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Or you can text us at 585-205-8887. And that's what Carol did. From Irondequoit, New York.
And her question was, I heard from a friend that I should do the iOS 14.4 update for my iPhone, but I did not get the notification for it. Do you have any information about this update? Do you have recommendations doing the update now? Thank you, Carol. Rich from Irondequoit's wife.
Yeah, generally, yes, do the update.
Yes.
One of the problems is that Apple has so many devices. If everyone tried to download it at the same time, it would crash the internet.
Yeah.
So they generally roll out over a few days. You may not have gotten notice yet, but you can always go to the general settings, general software update, and it will go and look for the update so you can download it.
Right. So you do want to do this update because it is being actively exploited. The thing it's fixing is being actively exploited out there in the wild. It's unlikely you've been hit. They're mostly going to go after larger companies and things like that. But it doesn't matter.
There are
computers, and they'll go after anybody they can grab. So do the update immediately. I know we generally tell people to not be first. But in this case, being first is probably a very good thing.
Yeah, safer.
And there's also, I'm looking at the models that need it.
I was about to say.
Yeah. So iPhone 6S and later, iPad Air 2 and later, iPad Mini 4 and later, iPod Touch 7 and later. So if you have an older device, it may not have that update yet. A malicious application may be able to elevate privileges. And a remote attacker may be able to run arbitrary code.
Right, basically,
really bad things.
Right. Basically, when you have a device, a program in your iPhone, or any of these devices, it has a certain privilege level that doesn't let it do certain things. But if you can elevate that privilege level, you can do anything. You can become the master of the system. And then, you know, any bad thing you want to do, it's not going to stop you because you're the boss.
Uh-huh. It's so like when you have to type in your password when you want to do something. You have to prove that you are the administrator of the device to actually install this thing and run this program.
Right. But if the program has given itself that level already, it doesn't have to reprove it.
Right. So all right, we got another one. When daisy chaining between two laptops, what are some of the things that one might want to be mindful of?
I don't know quite what you mean by daisy chaining laptops. Do you mean to
connect them to the network?
Connect them
or to each other?
I don't know what that means. Sorry, you'll have to let us know what you mean by that. Do you mean let one? I don't know what that means. Oh, yeah. Network? Is it network? Are you piggybacking off one for a network? Or are you talking about reading the drives off of another one? Or I don't know what daisy chaining laptops
mean. Yeah, I have to clarify that. All right, we got another one. Hi guys. My daughter has Lorex security cameras which work through the system hub and out to TV and out to the router, where she can view remotely. Question, Can I add storage for saving security video and Kindle? Don't know all the security details. Keep in mind, or keep up the great work, Fred in Rochester.
I'm sorry, what device was that again?
LOREX. Lawrence. Okay.
And generally, you put storage in the camera. You don't store it on your Kindle. So many cameras have an SD card slot where you plug an SD card in.
And you can save it to it.
Or there are other programs. We use a security program called SightHound that can read generic cameras and record the video to our DVR, basically, for our company security camera.
Right.
It looks like there's a Lorax hub that it all goes into. So there may be a USB port on the back of the hub that you would put the hard drive on to store more data.
Or an SD slot in that for some sort of storage.
Yeah. Yep.
Or just a USB thing. You can throw a thumb drive on it. But yeah, there's generally speaking, you should... As Steve said, you should be able to add storage either somewhere along the line in the device itself.
Or the camera itself has a slot.
Or the camera itself. Or you can, there are many programs you can load that will grab images and store them on the disk. And then, you know, you can say, I want to store 1,000 or 5,000 or 2 days worth or whatever that number happens to be. But there's lots of software that will do that.
And Lorax probably has some themselves.
Right.
Yep. Just check out on their website.
But it would be a hard drive connected to the Lorax hub, not on your Kindle.
Yeah. Yep. All right. The guy wrote back and said, no, not networking. Just a simple USB connector between the two. I want to take advantage of the additional storage space.
You can't use USB to connect two computers together.
Yes, you can.
Well, you can. Need, there's software that will do that.
You need to have special programs on each side.
There's, I have this device. It's called...
LapLink was one for a
long time. LapLink, but this other one, it's literally... how can I best... just a round cylinder. You pull it out. It's got two USBs on either end. You plug them into the ports, and all of a sudden, it finds the other computer on the other end of it.
So and you can use it as storage, or you can just move files back and forth.
You can move files back
and forth. That's not what he wants to do. He wants to use it as storage.
So you're better off turning file sharing on on one computer over the network.
Yeah.
Right. So this is actually what we talked about earlier with Doug. When you have two computers and you want to share files among them, you take the drive that has space you want to share, whether it's files or just empty space. You create a folder that would be shareable, and then you right-click and say you want to share it, and then you can share it to the network, and then others, and that essentially announces to the network that there is some shareable storage here, and you then go to the other machine, and it'll find that storage, generally in your list of available drives, and you can then store things on that system. Through that mechanism.
Sort of like I'm doing trying to do right now with the Raspberry Pi.
Exactly.
I'm setting up the Pi. The only thing it's going to do is have an SSD portable drive hanging off of it. It's a 1 terabyte, and it's only going to be for storage, but it'll be over my intranet.
Right. So what you're going to have to do is say, here's this folder.
Yep. And share it with, and I can control who can get to it and who can't.
Right. So you're going to need to share that folder. So you've got to create a folder on the drive with the extra storage, on the system with the extra storage, and do it that way. That's probably the easiest, fastest, and simplest way.
And safer, because then you got one local place for all your files, and it's easier to back up.
Right. Whether you use a separate machine or whether you use a NAS device, network attached storage or whatever, it's basically the same mechanism. That device has to have a program that announces to the network that storage is available.
Yeah. Basically, your Windows PC is a USB host.
Right.
It's not a USB drive. Most of the Mac computers does have something called target mode. where you can turn your computer into a drive for migrating data from one machine to another. But typically on Windows, you use a special cable and software on each computer to do file transfer between the computers.
Right, but that's not what this person wants to do. They want to do file transfer, wants to actually use it for as a drive. One of the things that Apple did at one point, which they did quickly fix, was every Mac that went out the door had file sharing turned on. That was an issue.
Yeah.
you could set up a program. I did this at RIT and said, you know, how many Macs are sharing? And the list just went on.
Oh, jeez Louise.
We were sharing them over the
network.
For
that whole campus?
A lot of early PCs were like that, too.
Yes, they were.
I remember when Roadrunner first came out, what, 20 years ago now?
Yeah.
You could open your network neighborhood and see everyone else's C drive.
Yep.
Because the C was shared to the network, and now suddenly you had a network.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So, right.
We got another one here, and this is a long one. All right. Good afternoon, gentlemen. First thing he said wrong. It's Cyber Monday. I splurged and bought my first brand new machine. And I also bought a 3-year warranty. For the more expensive range, a Lenovo IdeaPad?
Yeah.
Okay. I am teaching online Skype, taking screenshots, editing photos, videos. I finally made time to set up the new machine a couple of days ago, only to find out it does not seem to have a camera. Yet it comes with a camera and Skype app. It looks like I missed the store return policy. I am super disappointed. I suspected that I should be able to buy an external camera, but I thought pretty much all the up-to-date machines came with a camera built in nowadays. What are the opinions? What are the options? Thanks in advance. And I am a listening PS.
What does it say what model computer it is?
Yeah, it could be a 3, could be a 5.
He said iPad S340. IdeaPad S340.
There may be a shutter over the camera, a physical shutter that blocks the camera, so you don't have to put a post-it note on it. And so you have to open that shutter to get to the camera. But we're looking up the specs at Lenovo. There's been some interesting concerns over cameras built into laptops, and that's why so many people are now putting post-it notes or black tape over their camera. There are exploits that will turn your camera on without you knowing it. Theoretically, the little green light shows on, but you may not notice it being on. And so some computers now will have a physical shutter that you have to...
Right, so on the 340, which there's several steps you have to take. Yep. One is make sure it's got a camera. You should see that in the middle of the top. It may have a shutter that's closed. You should play around with that.
Sliding the thing.
If you do get an image and it's blurry, there was a protective seal over the camera when you bought it. And there is a function key that turns on the camera. That's the F8. excuse me, hold down the function key. Actually check the keyboard itself. Different models use different.
He says says no webcam.
Okay, then there's no webcam. And you can add one easily enough. Yeah. You can buy a webcam phone.
Yeah. According to Lenovo's website, the IdeaPad S340 comes with a camera.
Yeah, if it's a 340, it has a camera, according to Lenovo. And I don't know what else to tell you. But at any rate, to finish, look in the F keys. One of them should have a camera with a line through it. And that will toggle the camera on and off. But if the manual says it doesn't have them, I don't know what to tell you because Lenovo's website says it does.
Yeah, but they don't always update their documentation correctly for all models.
That's right.
They use more or less a generic, and for the most part, it covers a lot of the features and everything else of the particular device.
That's right. But if you do find that it does have a camera that's been A, disabled with the F8 key or whichever key it is on your model, and B has the cover closed, then there is a camera app in Windows 10 that you can test it with without even going to Skype. But if it doesn't have a camera, then your best bet is to buy one, and they're not terribly expensive.
And that's the problem. See, because they use the same bezel for a lot of different models, it might have the hole there for the camera, but nothing is installed.
Yeah, but it does. Lenovo's own website does say that that it has a camera, but it could be wrong.
Or it's a subversion.
Right.
Yeah, he goes, maybe that's why it was a Cyber Monday sale.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility.
Probably, yeah, they want to unload it and get for the next one.
The other thing is to open up the device manager and see if it sees a camera.
Yeah, there's another spot. And if it didn't, and the driver wasn't installed, there'd be a question mark next to it.
Exactly right.
Yep,
exactly right. But I guess your only other choice, get a USB camera. They're not expensive. You don't need, a 4K camera, super sexy, yada, yada, yada. Anything that does 1080p would be fine. Even 720 would be fine for Skype. Honestly, 720 is fine mainly because you're not pushing as many pixels down your connection. And if you don't have fiber, then you don't really want to drive that many pixels down your connection.
One of the big specifications about webcams is the viewing angle. I've been looking at webcams, and not, I left them in my car this time. They were in my bag, and it must have fallen out when I pulled the bag out of the car. But something like an 70-80 degree webcam is good for like one person sitting in front of the camera. If you do 90-100 degrees, you can get a few people behind you. I've seen some cameras have 180 degree viewing angle, and that's for like putting at the end of a conference table and getting everyone in the room in the picture. They'll be really small, but they'll all be there.
All right, moving on with another question. A few days ago, my iPhone 5S operating system was upgraded to 12.5.1. What was the benefit of that, and what features changed?
There should have been a notice to tell you what was changing before it installed. Let's see.
Yeah, people don't read those.
Yeah.
I updated to 88 on my Chromebook today, and the big notice came up that said, click here to see what new features you've got. And I thought, I don't have time.
Yeah, you can never get back to it.
Right.
Yeah. Performance improvements, that's always good. Performance and security, probably. I'm trying to find the list from the different blogs that point out battery management, so you can get longer battery life.
Always a good thing.
They fixed a bug in the COVID-19 exposure notification. Incorrectly display logging profile language, so the COVID exposure notification might come up in the wrong language. I guess that's a good thing to fix.
Yes, it is.
So it doesn't look like anything that major, but it's always good to fix bugs.
Yeah, certainly it's good that you upgraded, but particularly when it's an iPhone 5 and you're back a couple of
iOS 12 releases. Is probably the last OS it will run. So
right.
You can't do 13 or 14 on it because of the age of it.
Right. And before anybody writes in to ask, the new Chrome OS 88 does have some features. There's a screen magnifier, a new admin console for the people who do stuff like that. There's upgrades to the window manager. There's a screensaver now, and the screensaver is actually pretty cool because it lets you do all kinds of interesting things. There are virtual desks. There have always been virtual desks, but now they're fast and more responsive. And I love those because it means you can quickly switch among alternate desktops. So I do that. I've been doing that on Linux for 20 years. One of the big reasons I switched to Linux was I could say, okay, this desktop has my email. This desktop has my web browser. This desktop has something else,
Mm-hmm.
And I can, you know, and then I can focus in on that one thing rather than being distracted by six other things while I'm doing that one thing.
Yep.
So that's pretty nice. There's a there's a better camera app and some updates to Chrome, including tab searching and web authorization and screen sharing and things like that. And performance, of course, is always big. More languages. You can now add Amharic and Swahili. There's a QR scanner. The Files app has gotten better. Various autocorrects and things are better. And, of course, updates to Linux, also known as Crostini.
Okay. Great Crostini.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. We've got another one here. And he sent an example, and it's obviously the little screenshot that he sent me is a spammer. You know, it's a spam email. You can tell by the super long, nonsensical, at gmail.com. And it was marked as spam. So his question is, any suggestions on how to stop this? While using Spectrum Webmail, if I try to block a sender email address, I get a message. Error. Unable to save blocked sender. Only happens when it's rather long email address.
Yeah, Spectrum's webmail is crap.
Yahoo. Isn't it Yahoo?
No, that's Frontier.
Oh, it's Frontier. You're right. Yeah, but Spectrum. Yeah, Spectrum's is crap. Crap is the technical term.
Yeah.
For that, there's not much you can do about that. When you move to a real email program,
that's
like
what I was saying. Get a real one.
You will find that there's all kinds of spam blocking
ways
features
to block
that are already built in.
Yep.
I see very, very little spam anymore now that I'm using Gmail.
Yeah. Oh, no.
But the simple fact is that the email service you're using is not high quality, and therefore blocking stuff like that is going to be bad. I'm sure they have a limited amount of space that you can put in an address. And the spammers know that and have made the text the name of
super long
and email address super long.
And frequently, it doesn't matter if you block that address because they'll never use that same address again.
That's exactly
because
right.
It's random. If you used a desktop program like Thunderbird or some other mail client on your computer rather than using webmail, that would probably have a lot more options too.
Right.
All right, we got one last one. All right, this is going back to that Lorix system.
Yeah.
He sent in another one. Added storage to router for Lorix DVR limited storage and for backup Kindle data.
I'm sorry, read that again?
Added storage to router for Lorix DVR limited storage and for backup of Kindle data.
Okay,
good.
Congratulations. That's not a question, so I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, I think he's going back to the original question. This is the guy that had the Lorix and wanted to, we were trying to...
No, I understand that, but did he say he wants to add it or he did add it? Or I don't understand. Anyway, this is the problem with people not calling.
Yeah.
So we can't get it.
I'm
done
with
that. But at any rate, let me answer that as if it were a question. Certainly you can add storage to some routers. It depends on the router. As to whether or not you can use that as Kindle storage, you certainly don't need to if you're talking about books, because Amazon already stores all your books. You can go into your storage area, your account on Amazon at any time and see all the books you've ever bought from them.
And my guess is that you'd have to buy the Lorax DVR in order to have storage for your cameras. It wouldn't use a drive on your router.
Right. And if what you're asking is you want to use your Kindle to look at your images from your Lorax camera, then yes, you can certainly do that. But you can't. There isn't a lot of storage on a Kindle to begin with. It's not designed to do that. It is strictly designed to allow you to read books. And, oh, by the way, it does a few other things. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's top of the hour, and we'll be back with a whole lot more sound bites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More sound bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District, Jazz 90.1.
Online at jazz901.org.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Jay Vonnegut.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 7 minutes after the hour. We are Soundbites, and we have Fred from Rochester, New York on the line. Hi, Fred. What's up?
Hey, it's just trying to clarify. The system she has is a Lorex, got the DVR, all works fine by itself, but has limited storage. If you need to go back and look at something that was, say, a week ago, identify something, you can't. It's got, I think, only several days of storage. So trying to add storage to that that it can use also with a network. My daughter uses the Kindle for all sorts of things, email and writing stuff and a lot of other that would be a good backup. You're always saying that we should back up. So, you know, I'm thinking she could back up information from there as well to do all on one storage or buy two external drives and put one on the Lorex and one on the system. But I don't know if the Lorex, you know, I'm looking to do just one, do it all on one.
Right. Okay, so here's the thing. Kindles are not designed to be computers.
Right. Well,
and a lot of people do, but it's not what it's designed for, and therefore there are certain things it does not do well.
And what she's doing doesn't store anything on the Kindle.
Right.
Going to web pages and looking at Facebook is all done on the web at the other end.
Right. And so and even the books that she reads mostly are stored. So there's limited storage on a Kindle. There are a couple of things you can do. I think your best bet is to connect some sort of network storage to the Lorex drive itself. If she really needs something on the Kindle, Kingston makes a device called the Y-Drive, W-I as in Wi-Fi, Y-Drive. And it is an external hard drive that connects to the Kindle Fire using Wi-Fi. Comes in 16 gig and 32 gig varieties. They're saying that a 64 gig version will be available soon. It also works with iDevices. And so you can use that. But again, there's no automated software in the Kindle that will do that. So if she sees something she wants to save, she can manually save it to one of those drives, but it isn't automatic. Whereas right. If you can attach something to the Lorex DVR player itself, a DVD, whatever that's called, you should be able to attach it and use it as storage with the already existing automated software.
I don't think you can add storage. You have to replace the storage that's already there. I'm digging through Lorax's website, and they have instructions on how to replace the hard drive that's in the DVR with bigger ones.
I thought there was something about downloading. You can offload the storage.
Yeah, so you might be able to do that, but you've got to have a device to offload it to, and that won't be the Kindle.
There is a USB port on the back of the most of the Lorex DVRs, but it says that's for the mouse.
Okay.
For the mouse.
So you can set up your software.
We're a little handicapped because it's not a device I have access to. Generally, but if in the software, if in the manual, you can find a section that says how do you add storage, even if it's network attached storage. Then you can buy an NAS drive, NAS drive, network attached storage drive, and just put that on your network. And again, it will announce itself to the network as available storage. You connect your LoRaWAN drive to that, and you're on your way.
All right. I do see you can plug a hard drive into the USB port and back up your DVR contents to a second drive.
But again, that's manual. It's not part of the...
Yeah.
It doesn't increase the storage.
Right. It just gives you a second copy of your data in case one of the drives in the box fails.
Right.
Well, what it does is it clears, after a certain amount of time, it clears.
Yeah.
It just keeps writing over. It writes over the...
You could lower the quality or resolution of the video feed, and then you would get more days of storage.
All right.
But I guess the device was not designed to store data for an unlimited amount of time, and that's where you stand, I'm afraid.
So theoretically, you could back up the current data onto an external USB drive, and then if it stores a week's worth of data, back it up to a new drive every week so that you have the new data on the external drive, or the newest data will be on the internal drive, and the old data will be on the external drive.
Right. And that'll work. I just was going to try to do it with either one NAS, one external, to do both.
Right. No, I get that. Unfortunately, that doesn't look like it's going to. Now, there are ways that you can do that differently, right? If the LoRaWAN drive announces itself to the network so that you can see the files on the drive, and you've got a Windows machine or a Linux machine or a Mac or pretty much anything, you can create a program that pulls those data off every week, every day, every whatever you want, and then run it on that machine as a weekly
backup to routine.
Thing. Other than that, there's not much you can do. That sort of capability does not exist in the Kindle, so that she's got to have a different machine to do that with.
Okay. Alrighty, I guess that answers the question. Not the answer I want to hear, but
no, yeah. And I get that, and I am sorry.
No, I don't need to apologize. But
there may be a way to connect your LoRaWAN cameras to a different DVR, a different brand DVR that has more storage in it.
That's a possibility.
Yeah, that gets expensive.
Yeah, but that's the. I'm afraid that the device you've got
is what it is.
Yeah.
Do you know if the LoRaWAN can upload to the cloud?
I do not know that. I'm sorry.
Okay. That's something I need to investigate. Maybe we could do it that way and save because it is connected. It is connected to the internet to the
right.
router, and
yeah, you can do viewing on remote devices.
Yeah, she does view with her phone. Gets a notification certain. Motions or whatever. Then.
Right. But I'm afraid that the device you got was not designed. Part of it, of course, is cost.
Right.
But was not designed to do some of the things you want to do, and making it do them may not be possible.
They used to have a cloud service, and they discontinued it in August of 2019.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okie doke.
All right. Thank you so much.
Sorry.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks, you too. Yeah, unfortunately, sometimes what you bought, which was great at the time, no longer is, and many of those devices cannot be extended. They have to be replaced.
And it's very frustrating that most of the security camera companies, Ring and Nest and Amcrest, they only work with their own brand. You can't mix brands. There are generic IP cameras, internet protocol cameras, that you could then use with any generic DVR program on a computer, and that's what we do in our office. But it's getting a little harder to find generic IP cameras because, the other big names have sort of taken over the market.
That Wise camera that I got, the little $29 Wise camera,
it
only works with the software.
With the Wise apps, yeah.
That makes me angry. Yep. It's not what I wanted. But I didn't pay enough attention before I bought it. And it's only $29, so it's not the end of civilization as we know it.
The one thing I really like about the Wise software is most of the cameras, you need to pay for cloud space. You can view a live feed, but if you want to go back to see pre-recordings, you have to pay for cloud space. Wise gives you 14 days. Is it 14 days?
14 days.
Of rolling storage.
Right.
For free. So you can go back 14 days and see, you know, what happened yesterday. If there was a break-in last night, I can go and see it without needing to pay extra for that.
Right. And it has it does infrared.
Yep.
I'm very impressed. For $29. It's a heck of a device.
It's kind of interesting. We turn the lights off in the office, and they hear all the cameras go click, 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 click as they switch to IR.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Steve from Greece, New York. Hiya, Steve. What's up?
Oh, good afternoon, gentlemen. I do use the term loosely.
But, you should.
I host a Google group. I've got about 25, 26 people in it. And some people can, it's a private group, some people can access the group and others cannot. The ones that, and I'm sending the same link to everybody, the ones that cannot, when they click on the link, either get content unavailable or no content found. And I've rechecked the link I sent out, and it works great, except for these people.
Is there a common denominator? Like they're not on a device that will accept that stuff?
I don't know that.
Do they all have Gmail addresses, or are they using other addresses?
I did tell them all to use a Gmail address if they had it.
I have seen if. you can use
wait a
non.
Minute. He said yeah. The key word there. If
you can use a non Gmail address if you have a Gmail account. Because I have a Gmail account with my Roadrunner address because I didn't need another email address, so I haven't done Gmail yet. And that works for the Google groups for some of the clubs I belong to.
And I've actually said that they needed that. I don't actually know if they got it, but I did say they needed it.
That could be some of the problem, especially if some of them are still using Yahoo or some of these other services.
Have those people who can't see it, have they signed up as members of that Google group?
As owner, they are members. I basically make them members. I push them as members.
Okay, because I know that there's a setting in groups that you can change who can see the group, either anybody on the web or only members.
Yeah, this is a private group. It's a writer's group. So.
Right.
There is a way to join a Google group without a Gmail address, but you're limited in what you can do. You can only read and search. You can't create or join. You can't join a group without a Google account,
right?
According to Google here. Create, join, post, delete, or read a restricted group's posts without a Google address. So that could be the problem. If they don't have a Google account, they're not allowed to read a restricted group. So they don't need a Gmail address. They can create a Google account with their current email address.
Okay. With current email address. Okay.
Or they can get a Gmail account.
They can get a Gmail account.
And if they want to, they can then just use it for that.
Right.
And set it to forward any mail they get to the address they want to use. So that the only time they ever need to use it is when they're signing into the group. But there's no third answer to that one, I think.
Oh, I was hoping for five answers.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Oh. The other two answers are too bad and get over it.
Well, it wasn't a deal with it in there, so that's okay. All right. Thank you very much. I will reinforce what I said earlier to them. And if that doesn't work, I'll call you next week.
Perfect.
Thanks for the warning.
Yeah. You're welcome, dude. All right, thank you, gentlemen.
All right, have fun.
Boy, you insulted us both. Coming on and leave it.
Yeah, no kidding. Don't call us gentlemen if you don't mean it. But there are a number of issues. There are a number of questions on the web about this issue. And essentially all of them say the same thing in answer, which is get a Google account. I mean, they're free. It's not like it's a difficult thing. It takes 30 seconds. to do. And like I said, you can always, if you don't ever actually want to use the Google account for anything else, you don't have to. You can forward any email from it to another account. So the only time you would ever use that address is when you're logging into the group. So yeah. it's not a horrible big deal. Oh, yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Will from Hampton, Virginia. Hi, Will, what's up?
Yes, sir. Hi to you. Listen, the text question that I had asked earlier about connecting laptops, I have the Dell 620 that has like a 400 gigabyte storage that I want to use. And then you had mentioned something about file sharing. I have a Toshiba satellite that I'm going to be doing most of my work on. And so I guess what I want to do is activate the file sharing for the Dell then. And use that as the target drive.
Yeah, you set the Dell up as the server to share the file to the network, and then on the Toshiba, you would connect into that shared file.
Right. Okay, so what you do is you connect a file or a folder, and then you right click, and one of the choices. I think this is in Windows 10. Yes.
It's probably going to be, actually, I haven't decided. I think I might be moving from Windows to Ubuntu, the Linux distro instead. So it's a whole new can of worms.
All right. So, Well,
everyone uses SMB because Windows file sharing is sort of the 800-pound gorilla.
Right. So in Windows 10, it's basically the same thing. I mean, it's not... Mm-hmm. It's not difficult. So what you do is, in either case, you right click on the folder, and in Ubuntu it's called local network share, and on Windows it's called give access to, and then you just follow the bouncing prompts and add whoever wherever. So one of the nice things is you can give access to individual people or to everybody on your network or the whole world?
In this case, it'll be just the one.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm just saying that you have that
the flexibility.
So yeah. It isn't difficult. Again, depending on what operating system you're using, it's either, it's essentially the same thing. Right click on the folder, pick the sharing option, and then share.
Right. That's what I thought. Yeah. Yeah, there's just a little details that I have to get worked out, but yeah, I get it.
Yeah. And then on the other machine, you would find it, you know, when you open a folder, down on the left-hand side, there's a list of all the other folders.
Right.
It'll appear in that list.
The drop-down list, or I forgot what they call it.
No. When you open a folder, you'll see all of your documents, but along the left-hand side, you'll see more drives.
Yes.
And it'll be in there. Now, as to what it's called, it might be the IP address.
Okay.
Or the NetBIOS name.
Or the NetBIOS name. So it depends. Clearly the new thing you see, it's going to be it.
Right.
I posted a couple of links to different file sharing setup tutorials.
Yeah, there you go. It's not going to be hard. And one thing that I suggest that people do is when they create that folder on the other machine... You throw a little text file in it called "This is it" or "Here's the folder" or whatever. So when you open it from the new machine, you think from the other machine, you see it there, and you go, "Oh, this is the right place."
Okay. Steve mentioned something about he had posted a link. Is it on soundbites.org?
You got it with a Y.
Okay then. All right, guys. Appreciate you.
All right. Thank you. Keep smiling.
Thank you, sir.
Of course, he's in Virginia where it's not 14 degrees.
Oh yeah, no, they're going to. I think they were going to get a nice storm down that way.
Oh, and they're not ready for it.
Yeah, because this whole storm is missing us, and a lot of it's going south. Yep. So, like Virginia and all them, it's going out that way.
Yeah,
keep it that way.
It's a balmy 36 in Hampton, Virginia.
36 degrees.
Yeah.
Heat wave.
That's above zero. I think that's in centigrade, that's 42 millimeters, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Centigrade.
How that works.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm reading a story about someone who was coming from Canada and was talking with some friends, you know, and you know, it's going to be really cold today. It's going to be about zero. And the guy said, well, it's nice of you to convert to centigrade. How did you know I was from Canada? I said, oh, no, we didn't convert to centigrade.
Yeah.
It's going to be zero Fahrenheit. Oh, my God, that's too cold. I can't live in negative 20 Celsius.
Right. yep. Okay.
Excuse me. All right. We have one more question.
36, by the way, 36 Fahrenheit is 2.22 Celsius, 275 Kelvin. 495 Rankin, 1.78 Reamer, or 8.67 Rahmer. Just so you know. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
All right. Another question. I'm surprised that they even write this.
Yeah.
Because they go, does Microsoft have a free, in quotes, free, stripped-down version of Microsoft Office that only contains Word and Excel? Sorry, but Microsoft doesn't do anything like that for free.
No, there is no free Office. There is LibreOffice.
All right, let me finish the question, though. So Word and Excel. Yes, I have tried using OpenOffice, but the document that I'm trying to create, a timesheet in Excel, will not format correctly.
That's a separate issue. One of the issues that OpenOffice or LibreOffice has versus Microsoft Office is that a Microsoft Office often uses some proprietary fonts. And so if you move to another device, you have to change the fonts and reformat everything.
Verdana and Calibre.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You might find that works in Google Docs. Because they have a version of Calibre, or Caliber. I don't know how they pronounce it.
Yeah.
But yes, there is no free anything from Microsoft.
You might be able to use Microsoft Docs Online if you sign up with a Microsoft account. It's limited in what you can do for free.
Right, but you can do some things. That's true. You can do some things for free there. And so if you're – it certainly can't hurt to try because, like we said, it's free if you have a Microsoft account.
Yep,
and generally
free.
The thing that you sign into your Windows 10 with is your Microsoft account. So you should be okay with that. But beyond that, no. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites, right here on the Truly Great, and truly grateful to you that we can continue to be member-supported with your support. Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Ernesto from Parenton, New York on the line. What's up, Ernesto?
Oh, God. I finally got through. Listen. My wife is getting a lot of spam emails. She uses Microsoft Edge. She can't use Chrome because an error comes that it's not secure. I'm not sure what's going on.
Someone lied to you.
Huh?
Someone lied to you.
No, they said it wasn't secure.
Right. Chrome is secure.
Chrome is secure, yes. Anyway, go ahead. Sure. So she's getting a lot of spam.
So is there any way to do some settings on Microsoft Edge and also, or just jump to Chrome?
Neither will help much. What's your email address?
Are you getting spam through email, or are you talking about pop-ups?
No, email.
Oh, yeah, that has nothing to do with what browser you're using. So what email program, where is your email at? Is it a Google address? Is it a Microsoft address? Is it Yahoo?
It's a Spectrum email, and
That's about it.
Spectrum doesn't have very good spam filters. If you would use a desktop client like Mozilla Thunderbird, that would let you access your Roadrunner Spectrum email and have better spam filters on it than Roadrunner's website.
Right. The simple fact is that Spectrum doesn't do much in the way of spam filtering at all.
There's nothing in it for.
Right.
There's too many other services.
It takes up time and server space and resources, and they don't do it. That's why many people go to Gmail, specifically for the really quite good anti-spam stuff. But
okay.
I'm afraid the simple fact is that Spectrum email is not good at blocking spam. Never has been, never will be.
Okay, so she should just try to set up a Google account and then try to do her emails through there.
Yes, and one thing you can do is on Spectrum, you can forward your email from Spectrum to Gmail. So she can start using that immediately and tell everybody that she's changed her address. But if something does come to the old address, it'll still be forwarded to her new address.
Okay. Well, you mentioned something about Thunderbird or Mozilla or something.
Right. Mozilla Thunderbird is an email program you run on your computer instead of using webmail. And the Thunderbird program has spam filters built into it so that you can mark messages as spam when they come to you, and it will try to block the spam from you seeing it.
But it takes a while to learn what's spam because you have to tell it each spam message. So it takes a while to build up that knowledge, but it does work. If you want it to be more instant, then get a Gmail address. If you don't mind taking the time, then a Thunderbird system. And in addition, with Thunderbird, you can have multiple email accounts running simultaneously. For example, I have half a dozen accounts, and they're all in Thunderbird, and I can look at each one separately and see what I want to see.
But the thing, like Steve was saying before, though, is even though, you know, you use something like Thunderbird and, you know, you're going in there and marking it spam, as soon as you mark it spam, they're changing the name and going by a different name. Right. So it's like, you know, it's that proverbial moving the fence. We get up to it, block it, and they jump over it. And it's going to be it's going to be a forever moving target.
Yep. The spammers are doing all they can to get around the spam filters.
Yeah.
Right. And that's another reason to go with Gmail. They do the work for you. Nobody's perfect, but they're very good.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yep. Sorry, but that's just how it is. And that's true for everybody. If you're getting spam mail, your best bet is to change your address to Gmail. It won't be perfect, but it will be better than almost everything else out there.
All right. There's somebody else just wrote in regards to that last text that we had. It says, Jerry from Rochester, minimal version of Excel are Spread 32 and Tiny Office. Both are third parties for the 16 and 32-bit OS days. Hunt on the web for them.
Yeah, I don't know how well they'll work on Windows 10.
Yeah,
there's a lot of alternative programs that are free, but Excel itself, not really.
Right. Yeah. You can also get programs like Numeric and a half a dozen other programs.
Well, especially if they're trying to create it. I mean, if you use, like, say, a font like Times Roman, that's pretty, or Arial.
Right.
Those are pretty common. Instead of trying to create something with, you know, all this elaborate different fonts and moving it from one platform to another, use something that's very generic, like Arial or Times Roman, that when you go from one system to the other, 10-1 odds, it's going to interpret it correctly.
Right. Right. And don't forget, the person didn't say that the program didn't work. It didn't format correctly.
Yeah.
And that is entirely about the fonts you use.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just simply not going to change.
Yeah.
Because Microsoft uses proprietary fonts. You can get similar fonts, but they will not be precise.
That's why, you know, like we were saying before, using the open office or something like that, that you can then disseminate that out to whether they're using open Microsoft or an Apple product or anything else. A lot of these programs, it does, they don't know what you wrote it in.
Right.
They just open it up because there it is.
Right. Right. There, yeah, there is a program called Tiny Office, Tiny USB Office. But that, wow. I can't tell you when that was last updated, 2012.
That's back there with Edlin.
Yeah, right. It works. I suspect it works pretty well, but it is not
meant for nowadays.
Yeah.
It used to be Floppy Office.
Yeah.
It came on a floppy.
Yeah. It came on a floppy disk. Exactly.
I
right.
doubt it, yeah.
Exactly.
Back
right.
in the
so,
day.
Yeah. At any rate, the idea is that it's all about the fonts. It's all about the fonts.
Uh-huh.
I've done that myself. You move things from one thing to another, and they need to be reformatted.
Even Windows to Windows, if you don't have the same fonts installed.
That's exactly yeah. right. A lot of people like to install fonts because things look sexier or yeah. whatever the reason is. And that's fine. As you know, when I do that, for example, on Google Docs, I've been using Spectral right now because I just really like the look of it. It's clean. It's nice. But anybody else who sees that document, they're viewing it on Google Docs, and that font comes along with it, so they see it just fine.
Uh-huh.
But if I download it as a PDF would look the same. But if I download it as a Word document or an Open Office document, it changes because I don't have that font on my machine.
Yeah. Yep.
Just the way it is.
Part of the PDF format is to try to mimic the fonts used when it was created when you don't have those fonts on your computer to view it with.
But, right. And often nowadays under PDFs, it will load the font internally
yep.
to the document.
But going back to, I've done, for presentations for the club, I've had to do up some PowerPoint slides.
Yep.
And I'm doing them, you know, in Google. And I just save them as PowerPoint. And I send them off. And he, thanks for doing them in PowerPoint. I go, okay.
Yeah, right. Well, and again, if you use Arial and Times New Roman and Courier, you know, then you're going to get the proper fonts.
Yep.
But if you use something like Spectral or any one of the 900 and change Google Web fonts that are available, you may not have that font available on the other system. And that's just the way I'm using Spectral right now in the list of Soundbites callers. And when Steve gets on it, he will see it just fine. Because it's all happening on the web, and that font is available to him via the web, so it's not a problem. But if I were to download it, that font would change and may not look. Of course, it doesn't matter. This is just a list, but it would not look the same.
Mm-hmm.
All right, back
I see it as Times New Roman.
Do you?
Yeah.
Interesting. That's interesting.
He's back though.
Yeah, but he's on a Mac.
It's Google Docs.
It should be its Google Docs.
He's still
really
Mac.
Really, you're seeing the Soundbites caller list.
Oh, no, I'm in the news. Let me go to caller list.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yes. So the news is still Times New Roman because I just didn't bother to change that. Also, you get more lines per
yep.
page.
Yeah, it comes up in Spectral.
Yeah, there you go. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Larry from Rochester, New York. Hi, Larry. What's up?
Good afternoon, guys. I guess this is more a Dave Enright question. I have a nice little project I'm doing right now with Raspberry Pi 4. I'm, in essence, mimicking a Blackmagic streaming bridge by changing the software in the Pi. What I want to know is what's your feeling on the best heat sinks for this thing, fan or no fan?
For the 4s, definitely a fan.
Yeah, there are a number of...
I've got the heat sinks on all my little... matter of fact, I even had a couple extras, and there was one other that was sitting over the corner that looked like it's a little chip up by the... I think it was up by the network connection. So I had an extra heat sink. I plopped that on there, and then my little case came with a fan, and I've got that blowing right down on it.
Yeah, you don't need much. Depends on what you're doing.
Yeah.
I also got a case with a fan for my 4. It's just a small fan. But it sits right at the top and pulls air through. And I never get much above 60 Celsius.
Okay.
Now on my Pi 3, where I'm doing folding at home to help search for various cures for diseases, I'm up in the 80s all the time because it doesn't have a fan. But the 4, which is doing at least as much work, with the fan, it's but you do need a fan on a 4. If you're going to be doing anything at all, you do need a fan on a 4.
My computer's at 189 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, that's Fahrenheit.
And with two fans blowing.
Right. And don't forget, that's only 22 millimeters.
Matter of fact, I have mine, and I have it, because you can put it on either way. You can either have sucking the hot air out or blowing cold air in, and I'm blowing the cold air in because the case has enough slots on it that, the air can easily dissipate, and I want to keep it as cool as possible.
But whatever one you get, unless you're doing something really astonishingly high-end, you don't need a big fan, but you do want a fan.
Okay, because I don't know if I'm allowed to say names, but I'll say it anyway. Sure. I guess they'll come after me. I found a fan from a company called, it's either Adafruit or Adafruit.
Yeah, Adafruit, one of the well-known ones.
And they have a double heat sink, one completely encases the bottom, and the second part of it is either one that encapsulates the top or has the fan. And for some reason, I just like fans. I just think they work better because they're pulling air in and pushing air out. And so I just wanted to get your opinion from somebody that's always using this. This is something that I'm going to use at the church, but it's also something to play with, and it keeps me busy.
Yeah, well, we know that's good. That's a public service, really.
Yeah.
At any rate, yes, the Adafruit company is a well-known and well-respected company. Okay. Their products are good. I know the product you're talking about, it is probably overkill for what you want, but that's not necessarily
nothing
bad.
Wrong with that. I mean, like
if it's going to be in the church in the summer where it might get hot during the week.
Right.
Yeah, I'd rather have too much of the cooling than not enough because, that's just when you need it the most and then all of a sudden it starts overheating and then shutting down on you.
Yep.
And if you're using it as a Blackmagic video encoder, that's going to be pretty hot.
That could get pretty hot. So, yeah, it's real. Yeah, right. That's true. I didn't think of that. Yeah. You are using it for a fairly high-end device. So
go for it, Larry.
Go for it.
Me just running three cameras on my little adapter here. That thing keeps your hand warm.
This thing is going to have four cameras running through it, and then it's shoving it through the Ethernet into it and then out into a capture card so we can go through OBS.
Yeah, you may well find that's not enough, but start with that, and if you need something more, there's a company that makes a fan that's like 6 inches high.
Yeah.
Wow.
With a heat sink on. Yeah. But start with with that one. It would be overkill for most people and probably not for you. Sorry, what?
No, I said it's only $25. It's not like it's going to break the bank at all.
Right.
But it'll be long, in the long run, it'll probably be well worth it. Like you say, you've got this peace of mind that, you've got something keeping that cool and it's not going to overheat on you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, as usual, you guys are a wealth of information. Thank you much. Have a good one.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, I have to be honest, particularly during this lockdown period, I have come this close to buying more Raspberry Pis every week.
As I told you, what was it? I forget the name of the company, but I got this little 7-inch screen that you can hook up to your Raspberry Pi. It'll even work with 4s or 3s, and it comes with a cable so you can hook it up to the USB and do touch.
Nice.
And you can sit there and screen it out, move it around, and play around with it. And it's a lot. It wasn't a bad price either. It was a lot of fun. All right, that's going to be great for my file server down in the basement. But I'm having...
You could run it headless. That is to say, no keyboard, mouse, or video.
Yeah. It will. For the most part, it's literally downstairs in the basement where my hub is. That's going to sit on one shelf just above it. because I've got the power, you know, the power connectors and all that down there, and it can go right into the hub, and it's just going to sit there. I don't have to worry about anything overheating because it's cool down there anyways, and you know, it'll be in the open. So
my Raspberry Pi 3 is in another room. My Raspberry Pi 4 is behind my television. And I remote desktop into both of them if I really need to do something at the GUI level. But most of the time, I just SSH into them and do stuff that way. And that way, I don't have to, you know, after the setup, you have to set them up, obviously, on a television. But that's it.
Well, I've already got two others running. I've got one that runs one ham radio. It's called an All-Star node. And then I've got another one that I built, the little box that I showed you, that's got a nice 3-inch screen on it for DMR. And those are running constantly. So anybody around the neighborhoods within range can tie into my nodes and then get out to the rest of the world.
I created my Raspberry Pi 4 is running a media server. So that as I'm walking around the house or doing what I want to do, I can listen to podcasts, I can listen to old-time radio, mm-hmm. I can listen to, you know, music without having it loaded on whatever, you know, on whatever device I want to listen to it on, even my television. I can just connect in and listen to what I want to listen to without a problem. It's very easy, very fast, and it just sits there doing it all day long.
Well, like I said, the pies, like we told folks at Christmas time, you know, it's they're so cheap. And for the most part, once you get them up and running, you know, if they're going to serve a purpose, you don't need a screen or that. You can buy an inexpensive keyboard, wireless keyboard and mouse for when you need it. So you can just put the one dongle in and, you know, hook it up to a monitor or a TV. You know, if you got to do any service on it. For the most part, though, they don't take up a lot of space and they can do so much.
Right. Right. I have to admit I really enjoy Raspberry Pis. I'm a one use guy, right? I love one of the things I most love about Windows is that most of the programs in it are designed to do one thing well and only that one thing.
Did you say when you said Windows?
Did I say Windows? I'm an idiot. I meant Linux.
Because no, Windows is not like that at all.
No, I was going to say like that at all. He's smoking something.
I am, and I'm not sharing. I'm bogarting. But in Linux, I have these one, and that's what I like about the Raspberry Pi. It's even the 3,
mm-hmm.
you know, you do one thing, you do it really well and just let it do that one thing.
You don't do Windows 10 on it.
You do not want to do Windows 10 on it. Absolutely not.
Oh, that was so painful.
I do have to say that, I prefer the Raspberry Pi 4. It's a full machine. I actually used it for a while. As my desktop, just to prove I could, and that was not hard. Honestly, it was not hard at all. I was pretty impressed. Nice machine. If you're looking for something to play with, particularly in these lockdown days, a nice Raspberry Pi. The 3 will get you started, and they're cheap. And the Raspberry Pi 4s aren't that much more expensive, but you can get them with 8 gig, and they're much faster.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you really don't want to run Windows on them. You really don't.
Not Windows on Pi 3.
No, and even on 4, not so much. But like I said, I ran LibreOffice and everything on it, Thunderbird, everything. All right, that music tells us we're done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in and texted in. When you text in, if texting is not as useful to all of us, and that includes you, as calling in is, I'm afraid. I know it seems like texting is better, but it really isn't. At any rate, we're done for another week. I want to thank Dave Enright, Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. And you've listened to the longest running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, right here on the Truly Great. And truly grateful to you that we can continue to be member supported with your generous help. Jazz 90.1, we will see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?